Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. You don't know what you're missing because there's more. There's a lot more. Head over to rofpodcast.com for just pennies a day. Become a member of the program. Support the show. Get the show commercial free. And get three times the content. Three times one is three. Three times the content. Check it out. Plus, you get access to our archives of over 10 years. ROFpodcast.com. Either way, thanks for listening. Have a great week. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Professor of Economics William Lozonik will be here to explain how Boeing executives made decisions that put profits over safety. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the big news stories of this week. And journalist Rick Outson will join us from Pensacola, Florida, to discuss a bizarre week in the panhandle where one congressman was milkshaked and another Republican state rep laughed off a suggestion that homosexuals be put to death. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting the three-hour radio show commercial-free and access to all of our archives. You can go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, another crazy week. Let's start with a piece that you wrote, because I think it's pretty telling. The Republican Party has two masters. It's big donors, and it is rapidly moving right base that basically keep Republican lawmakers in line. And by in line, I mean firmly behind Donald Trump. And this week, we saw those two things come into conflict, which has rarely happened under the Trump administration. For the most part, Donald Trump acts like a classic Republican, as it were. And in this one instance, he has stepped out of those boundaries, and now we're starting to see a little bit of pushback from Mitch McConnell and the Senate. Tell us about this.
Well, first of all, let's start at the beginning. Apparently what happened, this is according to an article in The Atlantic, Trump was very upset by the Mueller press conference, and it really got him worked up. And what staff members told The Atlantic off the record was that, you know, consistently, and you can go back and look, when that happens, he turns to his two go-to issues, immigration and or trade, to, you know, change the narrative and to get people off of that. I mean, he was really upset about Mueller, and so this was the thing he went to, and it was a very impulsive decision to slap a 5% tariff on Mexico by June 10th. I mean, it was really quick. I mean, it wasn't like he gave any notice on this. And it was evidently against the advice of everybody in the White House, except for, of course, the, you know, malevolent Stephen Miller, his immigration guru, who thinks it's a terrific idea. Now, this is based upon the idea that, you know, there's been a surge of Central American migrants at the border over the past couple of months, and Trump says that he's going to force Mexico through these tariffs to stop them from coming over the border and stop drugs coming over the border, and they can do that immediately. Now, we have no idea how he expects them to do this, whether he wants them to build their own wall,
right,
or start shooting people or imprisoning them. I have no idea what that is. But, you know, the idea was that they could do this immediately, and if they didn't do it, that he was slapping those tariffs on by June 10th. Now, He has recently said, on his trip to England, that he expects those tariffs will be on as they're negotiating. In other words, until they stop, and by the way, these tariffs are supposed to rise over time, up to 25%. He says now that he thinks the negotiation is going to continue, the talks are going to continue, that they're going to wait and see whether or not Mexico complies with this as these tariffs have been imposed. Well, you know, from the very beginning, Trump's, you know, the business community was very upset about this. I mean, the markets really shaken. And I saw the head of the Chamber of Commerce and the head of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, various others came on TV and went, whoa, okay, that's enough. You know, the tariffs are really starting to hurt, and tariffs from Mexico on Mexico are absolutely devastating, because just this kind of just, you know, hardcore just slapping down tariffs like this, because trade with Mexico is humongous. I mean, they're one of our major trading partners.
Our third biggest trading partner. I think they represent about 14% of all goods that come into this country.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. And all of business across the board, from agriculture to automobile manufacturing to other manufacturers. And as I said, the Chamber of Commerce, which, of course, has tremendous influence in the Republican Party. It's basically a Republican interest group, kind of like the businessman's NRA. They're up in arms about this, and in fact have even threatened to sue the White House over this one. Now, in my view, they have only themselves to blame, because they put up with this. Trump was using bogus reasoning for all of his tariffs over time. And, you know, I wrote in my piece, they were more or less a little sanguine. They wanted to give him room to maneuver on the Chinese tariffs, mainly because China has, you know, had unfair trade practices, and they were willing to sort of see if maybe Trump's madman theory might work. They put up with, you know, the Canadian tariffs, the aluminum tariffs, all of which were based on bogus reasoning. Well, the Chinese tariffs not so much, but the others, bogus reasoning on Trump's part that these are some kind of national security things. Well, putting immigration into the basket on this kind of reasoning is really a bridge way further than before. That's never happened before. No president has ever used tariffs as a negotiating tool in an immigration foreign policy issue. So this is very strange. Usually, it's kept to trade, being the for obvious reasons that is the rationale for invoking these national emergencies. So, you know, this is a very, very big deal that that's happened. And you can see that even people like Ted Cruz, he was out there screaming about how this was going to, you know, throw a $50 billion tax on Texans, right? And these border states are, you know, very upset, obviously, for obvious reasons. They're going to be the first hit, although it's not just them. California, Illinois, I think there's a whole bunch of states that, you know, are really affected by this particular action on tariffs. And, you know, a lot of these Republicans are standing up and saying this. Now, whether or not that's actually going to happen, I mean, we know how cowardly they are. And right. It is possible that this is just they're just throwing up a lot of dust to try and appease their big donors. But these big donors are very powerful. They don't like it. You know, Trump seems to be having a temper tantrum, which is the reason that he's doing this, basically. And this may be one of those situations where we see some real infighting. And as it is, you know, as I mentioned, and you said too, it's telling that this is the issue over which the Republicans finally get upset at something. I mean, they didn't care. The kids dying, you know, babies being pulled from their mother's arms, right. Kids dying in cages, left in vans overnight in the middle of the summer, all that stuff. Well, whatever. But, you know, now we're talking money, and they are not liking it. So we'll have to see what happens. But I think it's potentially kind of a big deal. It's, you know, whether or not they could override a president. What they're trying to do is perhaps pass a law that would prevent the president from doing this, and Trump will veto it. And the question now is whether or not they might have enough votes to override the veto.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. Let's take a quick break. I want to talk more about this, because it seems to me there may also be another reason. That is, they may be extremely afraid that this is going to cost the Republicans the Senate in 2020. We got to take a quick break. I'll be right back with Digby as we talk more about the news this week. Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, before the break, we've been talking about this, and we've seen the, this a little bit before, but maybe this will turn into something a little bit more than what we've seen in the past. Generally, the headline here is Republicans threaten Donald Trump over the proposed Mexican tariffs that if he can persist, they will whisper critiques about him, to the press, basically, is what it comes down to. They'll say in hushed tones how upset they are. It seems to me that the concern that the Republicans in the Senate have is not just that their donors are going to be upset, but the reason why their donors are going to be upset is because there is going to be real economic pain suffered by many red states, as you said. We talk about cars and we talk about, border states and whatnot. These tariffs are going to come out of the hide of a lot of citizens in red and purple states. But also more than that, too, it strikes me that the business community is going to be upset. They are going to create a general narrative that the Republicans could have stopped him in the Senate. I mean, it's going to be interesting. I don't know if they have the ability to pass this legislation and pass it in such a way that overrides the veto. I don't know if they care about that, that they feel that they, as long as they do something, they can position themselves. But it seems to me that they don't want to be in a position of having to run against Donald Trump in any way on the campaign trail. It's fascinating because in many respects, trade is the one unresolved issue for both parties. Right. I mean, Hillary Clinton, of the many things I think that contributed to her loss, one of them surely was Barack Obama's insistence about pursuing the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this big trade deal. And that put Hillary Clinton in a bit of a jam. Trade is a very sensitive issue. I think the Republicans are afraid to be on the wrong side of it. And Donald Trump is actually forcing them to take a side. So it's going to be interesting to see where they go with this. And it's also going to be interesting to see, how many Democrats help in any effort to stop Donald Trump from doing this. I mean, on one hand, we're going to talk more about impeachment later. We have the Democratic leadership basically saying, we're just going to step back and let them, go at each other, or basically, let Donald Trump sink or swim on his own. I wonder if they'll take that same tact, when it comes to voting about the tariffs, because as it seems now, this week we had a federal judge strike down or essentially close out a Democratic House suit about Donald Trump reappropriating money from the military to his wall. Seems to me that if Congress doesn't have standing to prevent the president from reappropriating funds, which is literally in the Constitution as to what the Congress's job it is, I don't see how they can, prevent him from unilaterally slapping these tariffs on either, short of a piece of legislation, I guess. And that's going to require the Democrats to sign on board. What's your sense about where Democrats are on this?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know with the Democrats these days, but there was, up until this happened, this new tariff thing, there was a lot of activity, a lot of negotiation going on between House Democrats and the White House over the USMCA, the new NAFTA. And there was a sense that they were really trying to find enough common ground to be able to pass that thing, which, by the way, is not, from what I read, I'm no expert, but from what I read, it's not a terrible deal that basically is NAFTA, you know, with a little improvements in some areas. So it ended up not being a terrible thing. And basically, it's just sort of a vanity project for Trump to let him feel like he did something. And the Democrats were prepared to go along. Well, one of the problems with this new thing, it's not just about tariffs. This is about what you just said. It's about this overreach by the White House on presidential power. I mean, this is coming at the Democrats from all directions. This is just one of them. And in this case, it's actually coming at the Republicans as well. I mean, this is one situation where the Congress is, at least from the commentary that I heard during the week from Republicans about this, one of the reasons they're citing, beyond the fact that it's an economic, potentially an economic disaster to have this done this way, is that, you know, this is, they are really starting to feel this idea that, geez, you know, this guy, he's doing whatever he wants. I mean, he's seizing power from the Congress in ways that they're suddenly sort of waking up to. And he is doing that and has been doing it all along. And it's just sort of now starting to, I think it's just a cumulative effect where they're going, geez, he really means it. You know, this isn't a joke. He's doing this stuff. And so there's maybe a little institutional kind of wariness on this one. Which I think also gives the Democrats a way to, you know, to push back. This is just part of our argument, right? I mean, there's the argument over impeachment. There's the argument over the taxes. There's the argument over Mueller, all this stuff. And this is presidential abuse of power. And it really is. I mean, this tariff was, you know, thrown on, as I said earlier, without any real, you know, legal justification. There's no precedent for this, for a president using this power to do it. Now, you know, I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, I mean, this is one of our closest allies. It's our neighbor. I mean, the idea that the president would do this without any sense that they could possibly fulfill their side of the bargain, right? I mean, this is
that's the amazing thing.
That's impossible.
Right. I mean, the idea is that you need to build a wall to keep people from entering your country or, you know, and these people, they're entering the country perfectly legally. I don't know how Mexico is supposed to anticipate exactly what they're doing. I mean, sure, I guess if they come in a huge caravan, there's some semblance of that, but that's not how the vast, overwhelming majority of people come. It is really stunning, frankly, and I guess we will see. We're only a couple of days away from Donald Trump's deadline when the first 5% tariff will be instituted. I have a feeling he's just going to create some other drama and just forget all about this at one point. But I guess we'll see. We got to take a quick break. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, economics professor Bill Lozonik will join us to discuss why Boeing executives chose profits over safety. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
If I had eyes in the back of my head, I would have told you that you look good as I walked away.
Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Earlier this year, Boeing, the airplane manufacturer, came under fire when two of their 737 MAX 8 airplanes crashed, killing hundreds of passengers. Our next guest has written a piece where he makes his case that senior management made decisions to increase profit that may have contributed to the safety defects of the 737 MAX. Here to explain, William Lozonik. So, Bill, let's just start with there's two different dynamics that are happening here in terms of the safety of the Boeing 737 MAX. There is the story of and this is basically, like many sort of product safety stories, this is a story of choices. And this is a story of incentives that inform those choices. So let's start with the incentives, and then we will talk about the choices that were made. The incentives that you talk about in your piece about that Boeing face is something that you and I have talked about in the past. And that is, and so I want to keep this general, and then we can get closer to Boeing. But that is that in the early 80s, there was a series of changes having to do with our tax code and what monies was sort of taxed at a more favorable rate than other monies. And also a decision by the SEC as to changing the law, essentially, that at one point what used to be criminal stock manipulation was now just simply a strategy to theoretically give back to shareholders. Just tell us about those two dynamics so that we know the general climate in which created these incentives for Boeing executives.
Yeah, so yeah, in 1982, under what is known as Rule 10b-18, the SEC basically gave companies what we call a license to loot. They could just pump all this money out of their companies, not just in the form of dividends, which done in moderation and consistent with company investing in the future, paying its workers, et cetera, are legitimate, but stock buybacks, which are done as open market repurchases, I would argue, are illegitimate. And although they were never illegal prior to 1982, on the scale that they're being done, anywhere near the scale they're being done now, the SEC could have charged all these companies with manipulation of the stock price. And that's what they're doing with open market repurchases. So that's been going on a large scale since the mid-1980s. And companies more and more embraced that practice as part of an ideology that started getting widely articulated in the mid-1980s and was related to these changes at the SEC, which was basically let the money flow through financial markets and it'll end up somewhere where you'll be getting some productivity out of it. The notion that you maximize shareholder value, that legitimized basically this practice of just pumping out money to shareholders. And by the way, it's not giving anything back to the shareholders because the shareholders don't give the company anything. They just buy and sell shares. So Apple, which has done $273 billion of buybacks since 2013, they call it their capital return program, but they're not returning anything to anybody who ever gave them anything. They're just giving money to people who buy and sell shares. In this case, it's just selling shares. So that's the basic context. And related to that, there was a increasing use of stock-based pay for executives in the form of stock options and stock awards that gave executives higher pay when the stock price went up and they cashed in their options or awards. And that was really totally behind the explosion of CEO pay that and top executive pay more generally that we see from the 1980s. There's a lot of people who write on this who think that it started when Bill Clinton had a silly proposal to tax executive pay over salaries over $1 million, and that led them to use more stock options and stock awards, but that's not correct. It really started in the 1980s as basically, the whole world was shifting to this crazy notion that companies should be run to maximize the value of the people who matter least, that is the shareholders, and then forgot about the workers and forgot about us as taxpayers who help support these companies.
So let me just, if I could.
Yeah, okay.
So we basically have a two-step dance here. One is we adopt this sort of ideological perspective, which is shareholder value is why companies exist, for shareholder value. This is something now that I think we just accept as, you know, in the same way that we do gravity. But that's not necessarily that's just simply a political choice that we make. And then
right. The
second step is we make the top executives of the corporation, and maybe the board of directors on some level too, we make them some of the shareholders who also control the levers. So when we talk about shareholder value, we have basically created, it seems, in our corporations, almost a cottage industry, right? That doesn't necessarily rely on what the company does, but rather relies on what the shares does. I mean, this is the functional equivalent of you and I playing blackjack, and me having a stalking horse who's doing side bets based upon whether I throw, you know, the low card out or whatever it is. And so that's what I start to do.
Or looking at my cards.
Right.
You know, and signaling to you. I mean, that's basically, it's rigged. And of course, the executives know, it's even worse than that, because the executives know when these open market repurchases are being done, but we don't know. So there's all kinds of insider trading around this issue, which was made easier by changes in the SEC rules that allowed executives to cash in their options as soon as they exercise them, which they couldn't do before 1991. There's a whole host of things that were structured to turn the people who are supposed to be managing companies on which we rely for massive amounts of employment, really the core of employment in the U.S. economy, turning them to what we call predatory value extractors, basically. And it's done under an ideology that says that, oh, no, this is all creating value. But once you recognize that the value is created by the, you know, let's say a company like Boeing, those engineers who go to work and create the planes for the future, and hopefully they're safe planes, or by government subsidies. I mean, Boeing as a company goes back to 1916 and wouldn't exist but for government subsidies and connection to the military and various there was an article in the New York Times that was quite good about the Export-Import Bank being called Boeing's bank.
Right.
Government subsidies, you know, you could go on and on historically about this. But shareholders are just buying, you know, selling shares. If you or I have some money we want to risk, we can just buy the shares and sell the shares.
There's right.
No
I mean, no more than I, when I bet on the Red Sox to beat the Yankees, that I have helped the Red Sox win at that point. Now, So with that said, we have just a minute left in this segment. Just set up the dynamic. Now that we know that that the CEOs have a vested interest in their stock price, how does this relate to Boeing?
So Boeing, first of all, became what we call financialized around 1997 when it merged with McDonnell Douglas, and which actually was doing mainly military contracting, and those people became the top executives, and then they were really just wanted to grab all the money. Anyway, that was before anybody was thinking about 737 MAX. But of course, the only responsibility or fundamental responsibility, as we argue in the article, of these executives to produce a safe plane. If they can't produce a safe plane, then they shouldn't be there. And that's fundamental. And there are only two companies in the world that right now can produce the kind of planes that Boeing is producing. And that's Airbus and Boeing. And so if they produce a safe plane, then they're going to get revenues. They're going to sell those planes. And it was clear in about the mid-2000, around 2004, 2005, that there was a new plane that was needed, a narrow-body mid-range plane, what they call the workhorse of the industry, which had been the 737 series that needed to be upgraded.
Bill, let me stop you there. So we have this need for a new plane. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about how the way that the Boeing executives are incentivized created a plane that was not as safe as it should have been. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Bill Ozonic about a piece he co-authored in The American Prospect, Make Passengers Safer? Boeing Just Made Shareholders Richer. So, Bill, in the last segment, you told us, you gave us a general overview of how corporate governance, in many respects, was changed in the 1980s by things like the SEC allowing for massive stock buybacks, and about CEO pay becoming based on stock as a main ingredient to their compensation. And so we have this political change where we have corporations are deemed to be to have value based upon their shareholder value, and a almost simultaneous change in the way that CEOs perceive themselves as, instead of people who are in charge of building a company, they become one of the most prominent shareholders of the company. And if they're not the most prominent, they're certainly the ones with the most control of what the company does. And they ended up running their companies in a way that would maximize shareholder value, because that was their value, as opposed to maximizing the value of this company in terms of putting out a good product, or taking care of the workers, or dealing with the community. And we're talking about the Boeing 737 MAX, which is a narrow body aircraft produced by Boeing. It is the fourth generation of the Boeing 737, and it has been involved in multiple fatal crashes over the past couple of years. And so tell us how it was that the Boeing 737, when this need for a new narrow body craft versus the Airbus, how it was, you know, what choice did Boeing have at that time when they were talking about creating this new plane?
So basically, as time went on, and by the first decade of this century, there had been, since the time that the original 737 had been launched, which was in way back in 1967, there had been advances in avionics, advances in materials. And the alternative was to forget the 737, do what they call a clean sheet replacement, that is a wholly new plane, design it from scratch. And they could have done that. And they had a project to do it, and they started looking into it. We don't know exactly when they dropped that project, but the other the route they took, we call it the flight path they took, was the 737, what became the 737 MAX. And the problem was that to get the benefit of fuel efficiency, which come from engines which are produced by GE and the French company Safran, called LEAP engines, which became available around 2008, these engines are much bigger than engines that existed before for the same aircraft. That's how they get the fuel efficiency. They're made out of more advanced materials, be bigger but not as heavy. And the 737 had been built close to the ground, because when it was first designed, it was based on an architecture where you didn't have jetways and all kinds of machinery for unloading and loading planes. And so they already, with the previous version called the 737NG, had reached a limit of where you could properly put the engine, position it under the wing without it hitting the ground, basically. And so there needed to be a repositioning of the engines. And basically it appears, everybody seems to agree with this, that this created a certain change in the stability of the plane when it was in takeoff, where you could get the nose pitching up too much. And if it pitches up way too much, the aircraft can stall. You basically interfere with the aerodynamic lift that is necessary to get the plane off the ground and up to its height, that where it's going to go on automatic pilot. And during that period, actually, it's in manual, so the pilots are controlling the plane. And what we now know happened is, given that they went with that option, there was this problem of potentially what they call nose-up incidents, where the plane could go up at too high an angle. They call it an angle of attack. And so the pilots would have to adjust to this. But rather than have the pilots know about that adjustment and make that adjustment, basically without them knowing it, they put in a software fix, which is now known as the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, MCAS, M-C-A-S, and that was working in the background. And so the problem was, once they had made that choice, and there was this really a structural design flaw with this aircraft, and that exists today. There's over, almost 400 have been delivered. There's 5,000 been ordered. They now had a software fix, and they didn't tell the pilots, and maybe not even the airlines, about it. It wasn't in the flight manuals. In fact, they deliberately took it out of the flight manuals and got permission to do that.
Okay, so Bill, let me stop here because we got about two and a half minutes left here. So we have a situation where instead of doing a clean slate redesign, they kept the old design because they didn't want to invest the $7 billion. Now, of course, all through this period of time, annually, they were doing $7 billion worth of stock buybacks because the incentive the CEOs had was to basically make their stock more valuable. And had they basically announced to the world, hey, we didn't do a clean redesign. We probably needed to because now we have a software fix for what is a structural problem. They didn't want to announce that because that would have impacted their stock prices. And of course, that's how they all get paid.
Yeah. And so this is, and they, you know, even if they hadn't been paid that way, if you're top of a company, you might not have wanted to admit that you were producing an unsafe plane, particularly when it became their fastest growing plane in their history. But having this individual incentives, which amount to for the CEO about $2 million per month that they've been raking in, it's kind of supercharging that incentive. And they're making out, well, they're actually knowingly, it appears, producing an unsafe plane. And, you know, to make matters so worse, yes, it would have cost them about $7 billion more to do the clean sheet replacement. They had already done about $11 billion in buybacks between 2004 and 2008, that 1.5 times what they would have to spend. But starting in 2013, as the plane was just – the orders were just rolling in, since then they've done $43 billion in buybacks.
Wow.
So that's where we get this about $7 billion a year. After the first crash, there were the two crashes for the same
Bill,
reason.
Well, Bill,
listen. The same plane. Yep.
We're running out of time here. So folks got to check out your piece in the American Prospect because this is a major problem. And this story that you tell in this piece about CEOs being incentivized to essentially cut corners because it's more profitable for them personally rather than maybe the long term health of the company or whatnot is in many ways a metaphor, if not a direct reproduction, of a problem that we have writ large in our economy with corporations and their relationship to incentives. But Bill Lozonik, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome.
William Lozonik is the president of the Academy Industry Research Network, an Open Society Fellow, the University of Massachusetts Emeritus Professor of Economics. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.